29. I'm an alcoholic. I have a sobriety date that's June 10th of 2016. I have a home group that's Smithtown. We meet every Sunday at 7:30 in Bethesda. You're all welcome if you'd like to make the drive sometime. And I have a sponsor who I call regularly and I'm current with. I'm really grateful to be here. This has been really nice. Thanks to my friend Roxanne for coming with me, and thank you, Sam, for asking me. I'm really grateful to be here. So I'm just so grateful for the program of AA because, you know, before I came to AA, I wouldn't have been able to do things like this and meet people like you. I was born in a country named Morocco. It's in the northwest of Africa, born and raised, and ever since I was little, I always had this thing, this thing inside me that tells me there's something different. And my interactions with you, with people around me, ever since I was a kid, are just a little off. I didn't know how to act, in social settings. I just don't know how to. I don't fit. I don't fit anywhere. I would watch, little kids make friends so easily, and I'm over here, what do I do to have that? And I'll just copy them. Let me just do what they're doing. But always had this feeling that I'm a fraud on the inside, that somebody's going to find out who I am, that I don't really, I'm not worth being here. I don't really belong here. And maybe that's not everybody's experience, but it has been mine. And, when I was 16 years old, I had a date. It was a first date. And I've never had a date before, but I'm very, very self-centered person. I don't want you to know how, what I know, what I don't know, where I've experienced, what I haven't experienced. And if you tell me, have you dated or have you done this or that with a boy, I'll say, oh, yeah, I have, and I haven't. I just want to fit in. I want you to like me. And so I have all this image that I have to preserve, and I have to go on this date, and I have to, pretend that I know everything. And by the way, I still don't know anything about dating, but I had to pretend all of this at 16 years old, and we go to a club, because this is Morocco, there's not a lot of, minors can get in anywhere. And we go to a club, and I start, downing Smirnoff Ice. And it tasted good, and I started to feel relaxed. And that was not really my intention. But I knew that I just needed something. Maybe what if I tried anything that will help me relax during this so-called date? And so I go in, I start to have a few, and I finally feel like, wow, is this how people feel? This is amazing, because even though there's still that voice inside me that tells me, are you dressed okay? Is he going to find out, that you're not enough, that this is a mistake on his part? Like, is he going to, all those things that go through my mind that tells me I'm not enough, or I'm better than, or I'm less than. Everything, it was still there, but just tuned down just a little so I can just be here and be with you. And that was amazing. Like, for the first time, I could be in the moment. And of course, I overshot the mark, it got sloppy very quickly. And but I remembered that. I remembered what alcohol could do for me. Of course, at 16 years old, I was not an everyday drinker. I didn't drink every day. This is, Morocco. It's a, it's a Muslim culture. Women don't, they don't drink. That's not true, but it's just very taboo for women to go out and drink, and so it's not very accessible. But every time there is a party or there's something, there's alcohol, I will go like full on. I don't have a memory of myself ever saying, that's enough. I think I'm okay now. This is the buzz I need. There's no such thing as this is just right, because like all the time that I've been on this earth and prior to this program, I've never felt like this is enough. I'm doing exactly what I'm supposed to be doing, exactly where I'm supposed to be, and exactly with the people I'm supposed to be. I always felt like I needed to be doing something else. What I later found out, like when I came to AA, I found out that's what, restless, irritable, and discontented. And that clicked right away when I first heard that term. So my parents are divorced. My mom has remarried here in the States, and so I lived with my dad in Morocco until I was 18. And then I moved here to the United States. And I always thought that, you know, what is wrong with me? Maybe it's the backward people in Morocco. That's what the problem is. The people, they don't get me. They're not open. And, you know, that's why I don't fit in here. You know, people in America, they will get me. And, you know, when I moved here and, you know, I have these two things holding me back, the fact that I'm deathly afraid of people, and two, that I don't speak English, you know, so I can't make those connections I think I have in my head. And, you know, prior to moving here, I have all these dreams that I, you know, like I watch these shows, these American shows, Friends and Beverly Hills 90210, and like all these like college shows, and I always imagine my life to be, you know, like having a bunch of friends from different ethnicities, and we're high-fiving each other in hallways of, you know, whatever university or college I'm going to. And that didn't happen because, like I said, those two things. And in the first couple of years were difficult, but I would not talk to people because I did not want you to know that I was different than you. I already felt different than you, whether I spoke the same language or not. Like, I always felt different than you. But now I have another thing outward that showed that I was different than you. So I was mute. I did not want to speak. I did not want you to find out that I had an accent. And I was like, let me hold it in, all in, until I figure it out. And then I will reveal myself to the world. And then I kept to myself for a long time, and for the first couple of years especially. And then, you know, I was able to get into, you know, a place where I was able to get drinks illegally. And so I went to this club of under 21, and I go to, I grab a drink, and for the first time I'm able to talk to people. And I remembered, yes, this is the thing that makes me feel whole. This is the thing that makes me feel like other people. It's not the Americans. It's not the Moroccans. You know, it's this thing that was missing from my life. It's alcohol. And I started drinking, and it changed my life. And I slowly started to get friends and started to hang out with people that go to places like that. And just to describe a little bit how I lived my life, you know, I at this point I had a roommate. Fast forward maybe like when I was 21 or 22, I had just bought a condo. I had this roommate that I was friends with. And we got drunk one night and something, you know, happened, and I don't know how to get out of this situation. I'm not interested in this person. And I don't know how to get out of it because, you know, a normal person, what they would say is, you know, oh, you know, we were drunk, you know, like, I'm sorry that something happened that shouldn't have happened. Let's move on. But I just feel trapped. I have no sponsor, nobody to bounce ideas off of, and I keep everything to myself because I feel like I need to figure everything out. I have to keep it together on the outside and figure it all out. And so I say, well, let's instead of saying what I just said, I said, let's start dating, when I had no interest in dating this person. And after about a month, I said, okay, Lubna, this is it. I'm going to go talk to him. We're going to say this is not going to work. Let's stay friends instead. And I go talk to him. And in the middle of that conversation, I ended up saying, let's get married. And this is how I live my life, you know. And I married this person for 4 years. You know, I wasted 4 years of their life and mine. And this is how I live my life. There's nothing grounding me. I just go into a situation not knowing how it's going to go. I have no convictions, and I have all these values. Like, my parents had values, I was given those values. I just don't know how to apply them to my life. I have no tools to apply good values to my life. And even though I knew what I was doing was wrong, I just didn't know how to do anything different. And we go in on this relationship, and magically, you know, the first 2 or 3 years of the relationship, I stopped drinking. I said, well, now that I'm married, you know, let me try and get it together. And I stopped drinking for about 2 or 3 years, and we ended up moving to St. Louis because he went to grad school. And then I just didn't have anybody or anyone that I, or anything that was really familiar to me. No family, no friends. Not that I really had any friends, but I just, it was difficult. It was just me and him, this person that I didn't think was right for me. And after, you know, in after a period of time of being in St. Louis, I convinced myself that I needed to drink a glass of wine a night because that's healthy, you know. And I, at this point, I don't know that I'm powerless and that I cannot have a glass of wine a night. But I did, you know, successfully for maybe 2 or 3 weeks. That was the end of spring of 2014. And 9 months later, I was in the rooms of AA. And by the way, that summer, so this is spring of 2014, the summer of 2014, I was already hiding small bottles of liquor and small bottles of wine everywhere in the house because I did not want my life to mix. I didn't want this person that I'm with to know how I really am and how I drink. Even though he knew, I just wanted to get it together until I figure it out and then, you know, and then I can be truthful. I started drinking, you know, and things started to get out of control very quickly. By the end of the year of 2014, he started to say things like, you know, are you sure you want to have another one? Or I thought you were going to be the designated driver tonight. What are you doing? And that stuff really didn't fly. I did not appreciate that. I wanted to drink like I wanted to drink. And he was, for the first time he's been, I had somebody blocking me from the one thing that made me feel okay. So he needed to go. And for the first time, you know, this thing that happened like years when I first met him, I did not want anything to happen with him. When I wanted to break up with him, all those times I had the opportunity to break up with him, I didn't. And the one time I could is when he came between me and alcohol, and I said that cannot be, and I had to tell him, and it happened. And I told him that I have, this is not working, and I left, and I felt like, you know, like a kid when your parents are off for the weekend or out for the weekend. I felt like I could do whatever I wanted. So I left his house. In March of 2015, I moved out and I was off to the races. It was insane. I was able to drink in the morning. I can do whatever I wanted. And at this point, I was going to school and I had a paid internship that I went to. And at this internship, it was almost like a job. It was a job. It was a 40-hour internship. And my life became very lonely very quickly. I stopped answering my phone calls. I had my own place, which was trashed. I lived like an animal for a long time. And my world became very small. I would wake up every morning and, you know, very, very late for my internship. And I scramble around looking for my keys, looking for my purse. And then I'm driving with a massive headache and with a massive hungover. And I'm driving to work and I'm thinking, oh, my God, how am I going to make it today? I can't. And I go to work, and I'm filled with shame and guilt. I know that I can, I can do more than I'm doing right now. I give them 15% and I know I can do 100%. And I feel all of that guilt and I feel like I'm going to fall over. I feel like a zombie and I'm like, I cannot do this to myself one more day. You know what? I just need to get more sleep. Tonight I'm going to get more sleep and tomorrow I will feel better and I will give them 100% and I will start going back to school because I stopped going to school and I will get my life together tomorrow. And by the end of my shift at work, you know, I'm so tired. I'm like, that's it. I'm going home. I'm going to sleep. And I started to feel this excitement inside of like, okay, I'm going home now. I can do whatever I want. And then on my way home, you know, I feel like, okay, well, let me stop at, you know, a liquor store. In Missouri, they sell alcohol and wine and liquor even at gas stations and at, you know, 7-Eleven. Actually, Virginia, too, 7-Eleven. But, and so I'll say to myself, let me just stop and get a bottle of wine. That will ease me into sleep. And then I find a deal that says two, you know, two for the price of one, whatever. It doesn't need to be a deal. I just say, let me just buy them all at once. So if this situation happens to occur again tomorrow, I have enough. But the truth is I have a plan to, you know, my secret plan is to drink everything. And I end up buying more than I intend to drink that night. And I end up drinking, you know, three bottles of wine or a 12 or 24 pack or whatever. And then walking drunk to the closest 7-Eleven or liquor store for my house and getting even more. And then I'm drinking and passing out and drinking and passing out and watching movies on my laptop and chain smoking and passing out on top of my laptop. And then the next day, I wake up again. I come to and I'm like, oh my God, what time is it? Oh no, I'm late to work. And then I go to work, you know, and I'm filled with shame and guilt. And I can't do this again. I can't do this one more day. That's it. Tonight I'm not drinking so I can get enough sleep because the problem is sleep. I'm not getting enough sleep. If I get enough sleep tonight, tomorrow it'll be okay. And I go through that zombie day of work. And we know that zombie day of work when you're like dead inside and you're like, I can't, I don't think I can make it another minute. And by the time you get off, I'm like, okay, I'll just get another bottle of wine to ease me into sleep. And I end up getting more. And then it's a cycle that's just insanity. And I can't get out of it because every time I have that sliver of hope, tomorrow I can do this tonight. I won't drink tonight, so tomorrow will be better. But that sliver of hope keeps getting dimmer and dimmer and dimmer, and then slowly I start to realize, I don't think I can get out of this. There's no way. I know I'm going to drink tonight, even though I don't want to. You know, it is, that's crushing, and that's the powerlessness of this disease, is I don't have a choice. I'm going to drink. It is my only solution. It's my only solution that eases off the pain of existing. and one day I was late, a couple hours late. Actually, we had like a goodbye breakfast party for a coworker. And everybody signed up to make something, and I just and they were going to make pancakes in the office. And I just said, well, I'll just, I have vanilla, like imitation vanilla extract. Thank you. I have it at home. I'll bring that. That's all I needed to bring. I wasn't making anything. And so I come late. The party's over. They already made the pancakes. In fact, I live 5 minutes from work. My boss came to my house. They knocked at my house and my apartment. I was so passed out. I was so drunk. I didn't hear any of it. And I came way later, and so I show up at the office super late, super drunk, and my boss said, what happened? And I said, what do you mean? I'm sorry, I was late, I had this thing, and we always have this thing, I always had something. And she said, you know, I came by your house, and I knocked, and I said, I'm really sorry, I didn't hear it. And she said, what is going on? And the second what is going on, I knew something had to give, because all this time I felt like I had this excuse. I was getting divorced. My life is hard. You know, I'm going through so much pain, and I milked that for as long as I could. But my behavior was inexcusable, And I couldn't milk that anymore because it wasn't true. None of it was true. I needed to drink to survive. And when she asked me what is going on, I just started crying. And I couldn't say one more lie. I just couldn't utter one more excuse. And I said, I don't think I can stop drinking. And as I said that, part of me thought it was a lie because I didn't think that that was true. You know, like part of me is like, but I could always make that choice. Like logically, I understand that I have a choice in everything, but also like my heart would tell me I don't really. And I told her that, and I was like, let me just, I'll just, you know, maybe I'll get some sympathy or whatever. And she started crying too. And she said, you know, I lost my brother to addiction, and we'll get you help. And she signed me up for the employee assistance program. And the truth is, she gave me their number, and then I never called them. And 2 weeks rolled by, and I was still coming late. And she called for me, and she said, you're not coming back to work unless you check this out. And this was an angel for me. A divine intervention, because I wouldn't have done this for myself. And she did not have to do this. I'm an intern. She can fire me like this. I had no benefits. She had to like pull a lot of strings to get me into the employee assistance program. So I go through that, and they send me to outpatient rehab, and I start doing that, and they say go to AA. And the truth is, actually, before I went to AA through the employee assistance program, I had gone to AA maybe a month before that incident. And I went to a meeting, and it was a clubhouse in St. Louis, and I knew there was something wrong with me, and I can't stop drinking, and I'm just looking for, like, just scrambling for solutions. I look up AA, the AA website, and I'm thinking, in my idea of AA, you know, all these AA meetings are in churches. And so they must be for Christian people only. And so I said, well, let me look for another minority, you know, like in an AA minority. And so I scanned the list of meetings, and, you know, there's the Spanish groups, and I'm like, but I don't speak Spanish. And so I go and I find, LGBT group, in St. Louis. And I said, okay, well, maybe this is a minority. I'm a minority, so they will fix me. So this is how I think. I'm dying in the inside, and I'm thinking, who's going to help me better? You know, Spanish group, you know, LGBT. Anyway, so I go to this LGBT group, and there's two people in the meeting, the chairperson and one other person. And thank God they showed up, you know. And I walk in, and I'm like, oh, my God, I'm overreacting. What am I doing? And I walk into the meeting, and they said, you know, is this your first time? Yes. And they sit me down. We read. The room is empty. We huddled three chairs around a lamp, and we started reading the doctor's opinion. And I was crying uncontrollably for a lot of reasons. You know, part of me was thinking, am I overreacting? Is this too much? And part of me is like, I need to get out of here. But it will make too much of a scene, and they will notice because there's only three of us. I felt trapped. And I was also crying because I was relating to what was in the doctor's opinion. So I was just torn. Do I really belong here? But that's too much. Am I really an alcoholic? And so at the end, we held hands, and we said the Serenity Prayer. And then I turned to one of them, and I said, you know, I'm not Christian. Is that okay? He said, yeah, that's okay. You don't have to be anything. You just have to not want to drink tonight. And he gave me a big book. I didn't have any cash. And he said, you don't have to pay me. That's okay. And I felt this kindness that I've never experienced in my life. It was just the exuded kindness and the fact that I was just accepted. Somebody just was glad to have me here. They just wanted me to be better, to be okay. They didn't want anything in return from me, and that really touched me. I didn't come back, but when the EAP program, when the rehab, or you know, the outpatient treatment said go to AA, I had a good memory of AA. And I say that because it is important for me, one, to go to meetings today, because if those two people were not in a meeting, I wouldn't have had that experience. And two, to be kind to a newcomer, because I remembered that. So I came to AA and through the assistance program, and I met a lot of women. They wanted my phone number and they wanted to hang out with me and do things. And I've never experienced that before. I never had friends. I was just, my soul was craving a fellowship. And even though I was like, first step, I don't know if I'm really alcoholic, but I really like this. There's something here. And I'm really liking, hanging out with these people. And so I started doing everything they were doing. And they said, get a sponsor. And I did, get a sponsor. And started going through the steps. And all of this, I didn't really have a first step. At least I didn't internalize it. And so I started going through the steps and, started going to meetings. I think when I was 3 or 4 months sober, my second meeting, I went to AA. I met this really, really cool chick. She had a lot of tattoos and she was beautiful and she was awesome. And I was like, I want to be your friend, and I was following her everywhere. She had 14 days, more sober than me. And I thought she was the most spiritual person. And everything she said was like, gospel to me. And I was just like, oh my God, Yasana said this, Yasana said that. And I ended up getting her sponsor and was just hanging out with her everywhere. And, maybe three or four months into this sobriety, we had a little misunderstanding. I said something, she took it a certain way, and I wanted to explain myself, and she completely cut, contact with me. She did not want to have anything to do with me, and I was crushed. This was my best friend, and I was crying every night, and I will tell my sponsor, why won't she answer my calls? I just want to explain myself. I just want to tell her that that's not what I meant. I didn't mean to hurt her. And then she said, why don't you just say the third step prayer? Say the third step prayer every night. And pray for God to let you, pray for God to help you let go and direct you to the next right thing. And I did. I didn't really understand the third step prayer at this point, and I started praying it anyway. And I was praying, God, help me let go of this. Help me let go of this friend if it's not good for me. Put the right people in my way and the wrong people out of my way. I was just praying the things that my sponsor told me to do, even though it made no sense. I knew for a fact this person was the right person for me. She was supposed to be my best friend, and this was a huge mistake, and it was all going to be fixed, but I was doing what my sponsor told me to do. And after maybe a week or two, I was able to fall asleep without crying anymore. This was huge for me. Like, today, it's insignificant, but at the time, it was a huge loss of my life. And slowly, as these two weeks kept going, during these 2 weeks, I was still going to meetings. I was still doing the things I'm supposed to do, even though I was heartbroken. And the funny thing is, I started hanging out with other women in AA. I started having more friends. I started to do different things. And the thing that I thought was the best thing for me or the worst thing that would happen to me ended up being the best thing that happened to me. And this woman ended up making amends to me, much later. But what I didn't know then and what in hindsight, I realized, or at least that was my first, or I should say that was my first experience to letting go and letting God, for lack of better words, that I just did something that I didn't understand, knowing full well that I knew what was better for me, but I was praying for this thing, and it all turned out okay. It ended up being much better than I had hoped. So that was my first experience with the third step, doing the next right thing. And honestly, like, the steps were not a linear thing for me, even though they are linear. I did them like in order. I did not jump around. But I did not internalize the first step until much later. And the second step was the first thing that I really found here, was seeing the hope here. Because when you all talked about how you felt, how you felt when you were drinking, how you felt with the drink, how you felt without a drink, how you couldn't see your life without a drink, and how you couldn't see your life continuing drinking like this, I got that. And when you all talked about how you lived before and how you are now, I could see, like, I knew there was something working here, because the way you all described your stories were not how you were today. And when I first, like, the second time I got sober, I stayed at my sponsor's house for a week because I could not stop drinking. I stayed at her house, and I was doing step work while she went to work. And this woman had a crazy story, and she will wake up in the morning, and she will make us both breakfast. She will dress up and go to work and come back and go work out, and you come back and shower, and she will take us both to a meeting. And I got to witness how a normal person lives, because that was strange to me. I got to see the hope, because this person who lived the way she had described in her story was today leading a normal life, a functioning life, and she was touching favorably in her fellow's life. Fast forward, I had to do a fourth step, and I sat on my fourth step for a long time. I ended up going back out, and then I ended up coming back, and luckily not everybody makes it back. But I came back after about 10 days, and I did a fourth step, and this thing that was weighing so heavily on me, that I thought that, you know, if somebody knew exactly just how petty I was, like, they will not have me in their life, because I am very petty. And what I found out is my sponsor is also very petty, because every time I will tell her some of my resentments, she's like, yep. Yeah, I have the same feelings. That's how I react to life. I get it. Or I've had the similar resentment. And having a fourth and fifth step has allowed me to feel just like you. You know, one amongst many. And writing down a list of my defects. I think I'm jumping around here a little bit. Pardon?
Doesn't matter.
And so I had to write down a list of my defects, and then do a sixth and seventh step, which are really continuous. It's not something that I have a lot of defects. I have many, and I just have to be to do a tenth step. Really, I have to be honest with my sponsor and tell her what's going on for me to be able to be a better person. For example, like, I do, when I first came to AA, I had this thing where I wanted, you know, talk to a lot of, you know, especially my first sobriety, I would talk to a lot of guys, like, text them, and I would not tell my sponsor because I know she's gonna yell at me. And as I'm going through the steps, I will tell her afterwards. Oops, you know, I did this, but here it is. And that's where I'm in the sixth step, is when I tell her, you know, I did this thing. I don't want to be this person anymore. I'm powerless over doing it, and I don't want to do it again. So I fess up to what I've done. And because I don't want to do it again, I want to be what God wants me to be today. And slowly, as I, you know, as I grow spiritually today, at least in this defect, I text my sponsor or call her and say, hey, I feel like I want to text this person, but I'm not going to do it. And I just want to tell you so that I don't have to do it. And this is where I come to the seventh step. I am acting as if, even though I really, 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 really want to text this guy, I don't do it. I act as if that defect was removed. And I have this in a lot of other, there are defects that are still, I don't even know or I'm not aware of. There are defects that I still struggle with every day that I still do, knowing full well I'm doing, you know, like, you know, gossip. You know, I'm in the middle of gossiping about somebody, and I'm like, God, you know I can stop at any moment, but I'm in the middle of this really juicy gossip. And I keep going, but what's important for me is to practice a sixth step and tell my sponsor, I gossiped today, and I didn't feel good about it, and I don't want to do it again. And chances are I'll probably do it again a few more times before that's removed. Maybe some will take years. I don't know. Hopefully this will go away. And I had to there come a point where I had to write an eighth step. And I wrote down all the people that I have harmed. And that was really difficult because I couldn't write, I did this, but also they did that, or, you know, but then again, here's what happened. You know, I can't do a lot of justifying my actions. I have to just write my side of the street. And that was difficult for me to see how I react to life and how I react to the people about me. And I wrote that down. And again, my steps were not linear because I had people there that my sponsor had me. Why don't you go back and write a fourth step on this person? I don't think this does not look right to me. And that's okay. And I had to go back and do that. Actually, I have not done that one person. So I had to do an eighth step. And then I had to pray for the willingness to make amends to those people. There is an amend to somebody, a family member that I'm really, really, you know, that I have hurt a lot and I'm really jealous of, and I can't shake that jealousy. This person is a peer. We have the same age, and we were best friends for a long time, but she's done a lot for her life, and I'm an alcoholic. And I can't shake this comparison, and I'm always comparing myself to her, and I can't see myself making that amends. That is like I just feel like it's a terrible idea to make this amends. This will like break the relationship. And my sponsor, you know, has convinced me, and I trust my sponsor. And you know what my instincts tell me is this is a terrible idea, but I trust my sponsor because every time she's given me a direction, it has so far worked out for me. And that is one of those amends that I pray for the willingness, because I'm just not willing to do it today. But I want to. I have to be free. And I feel that every time I call my sponsor about an inventory, about an interaction with her, and she tells me, you know what to do, and I say, yes, I do know what I need to do, but I'm praying for the willingness to do it. And some of the amends, you know, I started making, so moving on to the ninth step, some of the amends were pretty straightforward. I had to, you know, find the person, call them, and go meet with them. And, you know, like, for instance, a person in St. Louis I stole money from, and I had to meet with her and give her money back, and she was very happy to see me, surprisingly. And that was that. I gave the money. I said, "What is there anything else I can do?" And she said, "No, just keep doing what you're doing." But some of them are a little bit more difficult because I have to change, fundamentally change as a person. And those were amends to my family. I had to change as a person. And all of my drinking, and before my drinking, I did not very much concerned with anybody else but myself. And still today, and thank God for AA, I never really showed up for anybody unless I had something that I wanted from them. I did not, you know, when I was drinking in St. Louis and my mom's brother, my uncle had died, and I didn't even call my mom to tell her I'm sorry and how are you doing? Is there anything I can do? And that really, you know, tore me up. And I didn't realize it. And here's how self-centered I am, because I didn't realize that memory until a year after a year being sober. It took years for me to just realize, oh, I did that too, you know, and let alone like going for days, weeks, and months without calling her back or like taking any of her calls. And she didn't know if I was alive or dead. When I separated from my ex, she didn't know anybody I knew. At least when I was with my ex-husband, she could at least call him and he would answer. But she didn't know where I worked and who I lived with. And she didn't know any of my friends. I was completely isolated. She had no information about me. I tortured, you know, my family in that way. I'll just cut them off of my life because they were just saying all these noisy things about what are you doing in your life, you're killing yourself or whatever. And when I moved back to the area and I lived with my mom for, the first 9 months of my new sobriety, and by the area, I mean like the Maryland, the D.C., Maryland area, I still hated my mom. I just couldn't stand her. Like, she would nag about things, and, you know, I just couldn't stand the sound of her voice. I couldn't stand her presence. Every time she came home, I would pretend I was sleeping, and she did not want to interact. And my sponsor suggested that I start having dinner with my mom. And I did not like that idea because I have nothing to talk to her about. And I lived in her house. Like, she's going to make dinner anyway. Like, I'm going to eat it. but the truth is, like, every time when she comes from work, I go to AA. I go to my AA meeting and I come back when everybody's sleeping. It worked out, like, beautifully for me. I did not have to see them. And when I wake up in the morning super late, she's already off to work. And so my sponsor said, you're going to set one night a week that works for her, and you're going to stay and not go to a meeting, and you're going to stay and have dinner with your mom. And I did that reluctantly. And I started to stay one night a week, and I did that early on in sobriety. That was one of those live-in amends that I started living differently early on in sobriety. I will sit there, and we'll have the TV on, and I was very grateful for the TV being on because at least I didn't have to talk to her. And I will sit there and we'll eat, and I'm like, are we done now? And then after, like, she will do the dishes and everything. While she's doing the dishes, I'll just dress up and go to a meeting anyway because I want to go see my friends. And then slowly, you know, I started to help out with the dishes. And so that made me stay a little bit longer. And slowly I started actually helping make the dinner, or even making the dinner before she came to work from work. And then I moved out, and I got a job myself, and then I moved out, and it was myself and Roxanne and I were just talking about this and how my relationship with her has changed since I moved out from my mom's house. I moved out, and I kept coming every Wednesday and to have dinner with my mom, and that's still going on. And today I'm actually annoyed when the TV is on because I want to hear what she, you know, about her day. It's insane how this has changed, because somebody that I couldn't even stand the sound of their voice. Everything that she said sounded naggy, even if it wasn't. Like, it just sounded like you were too much. Leave me alone, Mom. But today, like, I'm interested in hearing about her day, and when she's sick, I'm here to help out. And when she asked me for things, for example, like, she had an emergency trip overseas, and she asked me to watch my grandma, and I canceled, you know, all of my plans. And today she was asking me because she knew I'm responsible enough to do it, and I'm gonna show up. And I did, and this weekend, you know, I was with my grandmother, watching her while my mom was away. And by the way, you know, my mom, when I first started living with my mother, she hated AA because she hadn't seen me for so long. When I lived away, she would call, and I, you know, didn't answer and all of that. And now that I was living with her, she didn't even see me because I was always going to AA. I was looking for jobs, going to AA. And she would always tell me, you're just taking from me. You're just, like, living in my house, eating my food, and going to your AA. What is this AA doing for you? You've been away from me for so long. And this woman has never seen me take a drink. She's never seen me drink. You know, this is, I come from a Muslim background, and you know, she did not know that I drank, and I told her that I was going to AA just out of convenience, because I needed to tell her I'm going somewhere every night. So I told her that. And so the reason I mention that is because before my second AA anniversary, we were driving together going somewhere, and as I parked the car and she said something, she said, "Lubna, you have become so much more gentler. I don't know what you're doing, and I don't know if it's these AA meetings, but I don't want you to stop because you would always fly off the handle when I talk to you. You always explode. And today, you are different." I say this, and that touched me. I cried when she got off the car, because I didn't just stop drinking coming to AA, because this person has not seen me drink. It has not, I didn't just stop showing up messed up to the house or anything like that. I really had to change, and AA changed me. AA, with the help of a sponsor and a fellowship and with service, I have come to change as a person. And I have a long way to go. I'm by no means perfect. And by the way, like, I do a lot. I still do things. Like, I just talked back at her, like, the other day, and I felt terrible about it. And I had to tell my sponsor about it. And that doesn't happen often. It hasn't happened in a very long time. And so when it happened, it took me off guard. So I'm not perfect in that relationship, but man, has it changed dramatically. And I couldn't attribute that to anything in anyone but AA, Alcoholics Anonymous. Having to do a 10th step every night and going over all, you know, with a sponsor, with somebody else, with a sponsor, over my day, and what, you know, where I've been fearful and where I've been resentful and the people I've hurt that day and where I've been inconsiderate. Trying to be a different and better person, the person that God wants me to be, and be helpful to my fellows. And I can't do that without the help of AA and the help of a sponsor and without clearing all the gunk and garbage that I had here by cleaning up the past. I don't know. My relationship with my mother has changed dramatically. I have other, like, amends stories. I haven't made direct amends to my mother yet, but I know I have changed as a person, and that relationship has changed tremendously since I've gotten sober. Not just since I stopped drinking, but since I have found sobriety through AA. And my life today is so much different. Like, from you know, the times I used to, like, fall asleep, pass out, and, you know, like, drinking in my porch and chain smoking and not having talked to a human person in weeks, you know, that feeling was just so lonely. Like, when I try to talk or say anything, like, I have to clear my voice because I hadn't talked in so long. And having no hope because I know tomorrow is going to be exactly like today. And there's nothing I can do about it. To today, when I struggle with my deepest character defects, I know there's hope, because my biggest fear was that I couldn't stop drinking, and today I'm stopped. And so there's no reason why God couldn't remove those other things from me. And today I have a host of friends from AA, and whenever something happens, when it's something good or bad, I have a, you know, a bunch of people I can call and talk to. And whenever I'm up in my head, there's a bunch of people I can help. And service and AA has been tremendous. When I don't know what to do with my hands, I know what to do is to go ask, what can I do to help? And it started here in AA, is just picking up the chairs, making the coffee, to everything, every other area of my life. At work, when I feel inadequate, I ask, is there anything I can do to help? And those things I've found here in AA, I was taught that in AA. I do that in family too. When I don't know what to do with my hands, when I feel restless, I go and help. I get out of myself. I call a family member or I call an alcoholic and ask them how they're doing. This has tremendously changed my life. I'm forever grateful for it. I don't know if there are any new people here. This is something worth a try, you know, at least for a year, you know, because I didn't know if I was going to stay in AA. I thought this was just a little thing I'm going to try for a little while. And even though I didn't believe it was really going to do anything for me, it did without my permission. I didn't have to do, like, I didn't have to believe anything. I just had to do what you all were doing. I just had to do step 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, all the way through 12. And things started to change in my life without me saying, oh, it's going to change or not. Like, without being attached to any results, things started to change and my life started to get better. And today I have a first step magically. I didn't have to believe that I was alcoholic to be here. And, you know, thank God there's nobody at the door asking, you know, people, are you really alcoholic? But are you really, you know, or my sponsor didn't sit down with me and tell me, well, let's figure out if you're alcoholic first. You know, she just said, you're already in this room. Let's start with the steps. And we started doing the steps. And today there's no doubt in my mind that I am alcoholic. And this is the only solution, far better than what alcohol has given me, that could work for me. So I think this is all I have. Thank you all for having me.